When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, baby. Welcome to the Smart People Podcast. Sit back, grab a drink, tune in your brain.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
This nation will rise up.
One giant leap for mankind.
Hello. Did you know that you're not a very smart person? I'm not trying to be rude. I'm just telling you kind of the topic of today. Welcome to Smart People Podcast. I am Chris Stemp.
And I'm John Rojas.
And we're bringing it to you. We're trying to make you a little smarter. Today is going to blow your mind how we do that. Before we get into that, guys, I want to say be our friend. Befriend us. Check us out on Facebook, just Smart People Podcast. It's a small step that you can take to help us out, and we appreciate it. So now we're going to get into what we talk about today, and I'm going to let Roach take it over.
Sure. Today, we're interviewing author David McRaney, who wrote the book, You Are Not So Smart.
I wasn't telling you guys you're not smart. It was a lead-in.
Yeah,
that's what they call it in the biz.
I don't trust them. But David is a journalist who loves psychology, technology, and the internet. And, you know, he's a young guy. He's a lot like Chris and I. He likes the same things. He's an avid gamer.
Renaissance man, if you will.
Yes, and he's got a website out there called youarenotsosmart.com. You can find out information of his book, different articles that he's written. He's actually got a really cool trailer on there about procrastination. We posted it to the Smart People Podcast website and to our Facebook page. Head on over there and check it out.
That trailer actually is really awesome. This guy, I had so much fun on this interview. It's like right up my alley. I freaking love the psychology stuff because he takes every interesting thing. You would have to sit through like 8 years of psychology classes just to, you know, learn the stuff that he points out in this book.
Yeah, he takes, what is it, like 45, 46 different,
I think it's 45, yeah,
different things in aspects of psychology and how your brain works. And he writes, you know, 5-10 page stories and explanations of what those things are. And it's, you know, it's a quick read. It's an awesome book.
It kind of like gives you a little insight into why you do the things you do. I came away slightly depressed, but also I kind of enjoyed it because you realize how much is out of your hands. Like, it's out of your control. All the thinking you do might not really be necessary. So anyways, here, I'm going to give you guys just a quick little idea of what his book is about. So number 28, he starts all the chapters off like this. He says, the misconception. And the misconception is, you evaluate yourself based on past successes and defeats. Now, the truth really is you excuse your failures and see yourself as more successful, more intelligent, and more skilled than you are. And it's pretty funny. He starts off the chapter saying, for a long time, people believed that everyone had low self-esteem, inferiority complexes, etc. But research over the last 50 years reveals something kind of different. Day to day, you think you are awesome, or at least far more awesome than you actually are. And this is a good thing because self-esteem is mostly self-delusion, but it serves a purpose. You're biologically driven to think of highly of yourself in order to avoid stagnation. So, I mean, that's just an example of one of the things he talks about. And then he'll spend 4 pages or so explaining the science behind it in a method that makes you think and you realize you do it every day, these things.
Yeah, it's funny with this book because as I was reading it, I would get through one chapter and I'd be like, mind blown. Amazing. And then the next chapter, I was like, holy cow, I think that same thing. It's absolutely amazing. This was one of those books that when we got, I, you know, had a strong debate with Chris whether we should keep this or give them away to our listeners.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we both had that thought.
And ultimately, the listeners won. So stay tuned and you'll figure out how to get a copy of his book, You Are Not So Smart.
Yeah, and he got the idea to write this book. He started the website first, and it got unprecedented popularity. And it's because everybody kind of wants to know why they do what they do. And, I mean, that's the beauty behind psychology, at least in my mind. So we're going to turn it over to David, and you're going to learn why you're not so smart, but how you can change that. Okay, that's the silver lining. You can change it or at least accept it and at least try not to be as gullible towards advertisements and things like that. It's really good. Enjoy David as he talks about his book, You Are Not So Smart.
I noticed that you actually have a blog of the same name, youarenotsosmart.com. So right. It seems you started to write there first prior to writing for the book. How did you come up with the idea for the book? And then how did you, you know, come up with the idea for writing for the blog as well?
Well, I never actually thought this would be a book. It was just a fun side project. I work in new media and I've been a journalist for a while. And when I was in college, I thought I was going to be a psychologist for the first 2 years. So I studied a lot of psychology, took a lot of classes, had lots of notes and lots of things that I could remember popping out to that stood out to me, things that gave me these the greatest epiphanies. Always tended to be the things that knocked me off my pedestal or threw me for a loop. So those were also the things that I would bring up at parties or long trips, much to the chagrin of my friends. Being a Debbie Downer with psychology, I learned quickly wasn't a good way to keep friends or have people help you move. But I thought it was still fun stuff, and I wanted to write about it in a way that was fun and interesting and not so purely academic. It had a lot of real-world examples. And at first, the blog started out as just being one of those blogs that points to interesting things around the Internet. But the more I wrote about it, the more I learned about it, the more I started trying to fill out the blogs and make them long, the blog entries, make them longer, have more research, point to more studies. And that has led to the popularity of the blog, and that led to some offers to turn it into a book. And so the book is sort of, about half of it is the blog, but expanded, revised, polished up, re-researched, that sort of thing. And the other half is completely new material that I went and researched and wrote about just for the book.
David, I got to say first that I absolutely love your book. I'm currently considering getting my master's in psychology, and your book is basically a conglomeration of everything that's interesting, in my opinion at least, about the way we think and things like that. So just wanted to let you know that up front.
Oh, thanks, man.
No problem. And again, the book is called You Are Not So Smart, which is catchy. And on the front, it talks about, you know, why you have too many friends on Facebook and just a lot of relevant things. So the first thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, in your book, you talk about 48 misconceptions most people have about our way of thinking as humans. And basically, this comes across as 48 mistakes we make on a daily basis. And as I mentioned, I love the book, but it kind of depressed me because you realize how flawed we are. I wanted to ask you, why are we so flawed? I mean, if we're this fantastic creature, why are we given so many problems? And then are these actual problems, or are these just survival mechanisms that are no longer relevant?
It's a mix of a lot of different things. One definitely is that these are a lot of this stuff is pattern recognition that has served us well in the best situations. It's recognizing the agency behind things that may not have any agency at all. Then a lot of the things are things that were evolutionarily sound as strategies of thinking, strategies of perception, but now in modern, barring a zombie apocalypse or a worldwide food shortage or something, we don't use these things as much as we would need to, as much as we used to. So a lot of that stuff falls into that. And the other stuff that I write about, the biases and the heuristics, these are more often the brain sacrificing accuracy for speed, and which is something we tend to do a great deal. And that also, I guess, is evolutionary. You think about it, it has served us well coming up to this point. I do avoid prescriptive advice in the book. For one thing, I'm just not qualified to give it. And for the other, the point I'm trying to make is that you're unaware of how unaware you are, and you're the unreliable narrator in the story of your life. And that means you're naturally hindered in the thinking in certain ways and not in others. And the world around us, not just the grand scale of politics and technology and everything, but also on our personal lives, it's the world we live in is a product of dealing with those delusions and not necessarily overcoming them. And I think it would be we'd be better served if we childproofed our homes, childproofed our lives against these delusions instead of trusting ourselves to be able to overcome them. Because if we make it difficult for children to harm themselves instead of trying to just talk them some sense into them, and we outsmart them, then we also could probably outsmart our future selves in the same way. So I'm saying you wouldn't build a car for a person with four legs. And so let's not base our decisions on the idea that there are people who aren't greedy, who aren't procrastinators, who will abstain from sex just because they should, or who will save for retirement just because they should. My philosophy, and you can take it or leave it, this is the way I look at it, is like we should base our decisions, laws, and policies on our real selves and not our better angels. And we should attempt to change and use science to do that, but recognize that's a slow-going process.
So you have a trailer for your book, I guess you would call it a trailer, on YouTube and on your site, and it talks about procrastination. And, I mean, Chris will completely agree with me on this, and I'm one of the biggest procrastinators, and I never really knew why. And your explanation of the now you versus the future you really cleared that up for me. Could you go ahead and, you know, kind of explain to our listeners what you meant by that?
When I knew that I had gotten a book deal, I knew that my own procrastination was going to be the one thing I would have to overcome. And I had all these preconceived notions about what procrastination was. And I thought, you know, why not just use that as a topic and let's dive into it. And when I was digging up all the studies about procrastination, I realized it kept coming back to me that it wasn't laziness. It was more not having an adequate strategy to deal with your future self. And I use future self, present self to describe something that in psychology is called present bias. Present bias is when you assume that the person you are now, all the wants and desires and the failings and the intentions that you have at this very moment are going to be the same ones you have in a week or a month or when you get off work today. And it's just not true. You know, we are very influenced by our environment. We're very influenced by what is affecting us from minute to minute. And it feels like we're a consistent person, but we tend to change over time. So the study that really made that make sense to me was a study into how people – I used Netflix as my example because I know that my Netflix queue is always chock full of stuff that I should be watching, but that I sacrifice every night for stuff that's fun and or stuff that I just saw in the list, and I go for it instead of something in the queue. The study was they had to pick three movies to watch over the course of 3 days, like one movie today, and then 2 days another, and then a couple of days another. And they gave them this bank of movies they had to pick from, and some of them were lowbrow, and this is the scientist talking. Some were lowbrow and some were highbrow. The lowbrow ones were things like The Mask or Speed, and the highbrow ones were things like The Piano or Schindler's List. Now, everyone picked the highbrow movie as one of their three, or more often than not they would, but they would always pick it as the third movie. So it was one of those things with, like, I know this is nutritious and good for me, but I would rather have a candy bar right now. And when they would change the study to say, let's pick a movie, you have to watch all three movies back to back, people tended to not even pick Schindler's List anymore. They would just pick three candy bars. And that's something that we, as human beings, are all succumbed to. It's called a time inconsistency. We think that we, in the future, we're going to be really awesome and good to ourselves, and we're going to eat the salad, but when we get there, we eat the chocolate cake. And it's not really a weakness. It's just a failure to think about thinking. The other great example that really drives it home is the Mitchell experiments, where they had children look at, they gave them a marshmallow, and they said, they also gave them a bunch of other treats too, but the marshmallow is the one that's the most interesting. They would give them this giant marshmallow, and these are little children, and they would say, okay, you can have two marshmallows. We'll give you this one and another if you can wait a certain amount of time, like 5 minutes, you know. I'm going to walk out of the room, and then when I come back, if the marshmallow is still there, you get two. Well, not all the kids could take it. A lot of kids, before the experiment even touched the doorknob, they ate the marshmallow. But what was more interesting was the difference between the two groups of kids who were trying not to eat the marshmallow. Some of them stared at it and smelled it and licked it and thought about it. And the other group of kids, they would spin around in a chair and they would bang their head against the table. They'd slap their face. They'd sing little songs. They would do everything they could to not think about the marshmallow. Now, even though the study was more about the delayed gratification, and the study shows that the over time, the people, the kids who could delay their gratification were the ones who ended up having better jobs and careers and better marriages and making more money and all that kind of stuff. So that's likely to be drug addicts and such. But the part that I found most interesting was that how did they delay gratification? Well, the trick was not to stare at the marshmallow, because you can't trust yourself to stare at it. You had to come up with strategies to avoid staring at it. So knowing that we take the sure thing in the moment, and knowing that we have to outsmart ourselves because we can't trust our future self to give us what we want, I talk about procrastination in the sense of having a strategy to outsmart your future self. It's a person in the future that's going to be you, and you can't trust them.
Now, that's awesome. I really wish that I know you said you didn't put any like prescribing notions in there, but for this chapter, at least, just how to overcome that, because I'm terrible with it.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that's my strategy. Like, I know I can't trust myself to start playing video games or getting on social media when I have a deadline. So I use, it's called Premax Principle, where you, if you do something that you, before you can do something you want to do, you have to do something that you don't want to do. And, you know, they make programs that'll turn off the internet for a certain period of time, or they make programs that will limit certain websites. You can go that far if you have to, but it's all about thinking about thinking and thinking about your future self.
If you made John download a program that turned off the internet, he would literally cease to exist. So I don't think he can, can quite go that far.
I actually have one installed on my computer, and I used it once, and it just, I mean, it did exactly what it was supposed to do. And I hated that.
Right.
But anyways, David, you mentioned when talking about procrastination, how we are affected by our environment more than we realize. And you tend to dive into that topic throughout the book. And one of those you talk about is called priming, which is, I'll let you kind of explain it a little better. But one of the things I took away from that is you say, if you neglect your personal space and allow clutter and chaos to creep in, it will affect you and allow clutter into your life. And we've talked in the past how this idea relates to making your bed every morning and how that leads to a more productive, peaceful day. So can you describe priming, and then do you think things like making your bed do lead to a more productive day, and what is the science behind this?
Well, priming is one of the creepiest things that science has revealed, and the easiest way to think of it is if you go to work in flip-flops and shorts versus going to work in a nice fitted suit with a tie, does it affect your behavior? Do you become more professional when you wear professional clothes, or do you wear professional clothes, you know, to put out a sense of professionalism? The science says that priming is always affecting us, maybe just a little bit here and there, but enough over time to really push our behaviors, really push our decisions to change the way we see the world. The study that cracks me up that I have in the book is they would do a different study, and then as a reward they'd be like, okay, here's some refreshments, why don't we tally up the results, and they would give you a crumbly cookie. And what they were really doing is the scientists behind the mirror watching this person eat the crumbly cookie, and as the table got peppered with crumbs, they wanted to see how often would people clean up their mess. And they found that if there was a faint scent of cleaning fluid in the room, a faint scent of some sort of cleaning product, people were much more likely to clean up their crumbs. They were primed by that smell to think, oh, yes, this is a clean place. Maybe I should keep it clean. In another study, they had people, part of a study, they had to remember a sin from their past, remember something from their past they were ashamed of, something they wished they could go back and change, something they regretted. And they said, in the study, they had to give people an opportunity to wash their hands before moving on to the next part of the study. Some people washed, some people didn't. And then at the end of the study, they said, would you do a favor for the researcher? No more. You're not going to get any extra money or any extra points, but you this would be a great favor to us. You just have to do another study with us. So the people who did not wash their hands, they were like 75% more likely to say yes than the people who did wash their hands. And the idea of the researcher saying they had subconsciously, they'd been primed to think that they had cleaned away their sins and didn't need to do the favor to feel like they were good people, to get rid of that nasty thought they got from the sin from their past. And other studies, and this has been in other books, and I mentioned it briefly in mine, when people have to do word puzzles, and they'll say, the one study I talk about most, they do word puzzles that are related to, that have words in the word bank, like briefcase, fountain pen, stuff like that, conference table. And then they have those people perform a negotiating task. The people who got neutral objects, like whale and backpack, they would tend to be very fair in their negotiation. But the people who had done word puzzles that had briefcases and fountain pens in them, they tended to be very aggressive and tried to maximize their profit. And because they had been primed, you know, every object, everything around you, every thought, every object, every piece of entertainment, it's going to cause this cascade of associations throughout your brain. And that your brain sort of it's like flexing its muscles, getting ready to run. It already has a little bit of the information there, ready to go, and you think more quickly in the direction that you've already been primed to think. And we don't realize it. This stuff actually works much better when we're unconsciously primed, but it's always pushing us around and changing our behaviors.
That is one of the creepier things in science. I mean, just to think that there are, you know, outside environments that cause us to act and behave one way or another. I mean, you take that into that whole thing of this information getting into the wrong hand, you know, people can do complete evil with it, which, you know, you think about like commercials and advertising and stuff like that, and you start to see that those things show up there.
When the lady is making the Rice Krispie treats with her mom and her and with her children, you know, they're priming you to think about whenever you did stuff like that with your parents, so that you will have a nice positive thought about the Rice Krispie treats. Now, is that bad? I mean, you know, from the advertiser's perspective, from the manufacturer's perspective, they're like, well, I mean, what's wrong with feeling good about things? So yeah, it can go either way. It just is. And I try to point that out a lot in the book, that these are just the way we are. And whatever positive or negative results come from succumbing to these things or from using these things, that's beside the point.
Now, you know, last month was the anniversary of September 11th, and there was a lot of documentaries on about, you know, what people did on that day that were in the towers and how calm they were, you know, coming down the stairs and all that kind of stuff. I mean, of course, you had the people that did have to rely on instincts. But one of the chapters that you write about is the normalcy bias. And this is, you know, our brain acting like things are normal instead of panicking. And, you know, on 9/11, the perfect example was people were walking down the stairs, and you said they were basically begging the world to return to normalcy, or to return to normal by engaging in acts of normalcy.
Right.
Can you explain to our listeners really what the normalcy bias is?
We all know about freezing whenever we're scared, and that's called bradycardia. That's pretty much all mammals, and well, almost all creatures do this. This is when you're just trying to avoid being eaten. Because you know that if you freeze, it's the whole Jurassic Park thing, you can freeze. So people do that. They can even induce that in the lab by just showing you pictures of injured people. People, their muscles will tense, their heart rate will plummet. So they're preparing to freeze in case this is predation. Or at least that's the speculation, is why you're freezing. And there's also thanatosis, which is when animals pretend to be dead by freezing. So those two things aside, what I'm talking about is normalcy bias. And that is when you're in a situation that's called negative panic, by first responders and people who worry about traffic flow when people are escaping a stadium or whatever. In anything, in any really giant, ambiguous, bigger than life emergency, you know, mile wide tornado, hurricane, ship sinking, building on fire, flood, a lot of people mill around and don't do anything, and they keep searching for meaning and searching for to get enough evidence to get alarmed and to pass the point where they will be able to escape. A big, scary, dangerous, and life-threatening thing, when it comes around, the first thing we want to do is believe that things are not dangerous or scary or life-threatening. And by attempting to convince ourselves that everything is okay, we engage in what, and like you said, we engage in acts of normalcy. So people will tend to just walk around and go, hey, what's going on? Light a cigarette, make a phone call, talk to a friend and family. Keep trying to gather information, because you really do want to get alarmed in case it is real, but people don't, you don't just jump to the alarm state. You move slowly through a series of steps. And if enough things make you alert and you get enough warnings, and I talk about in the book that if you've done enough drills and you've trained yourself, you will go through that series of checking, that series of engaging in acts of normalcy, you will go through that really quickly, and you will go to the alarm state faster. You can't stop yourself from doing the whole cognition, perception, comprehension thing, but you can go through the steps faster because you prepared yourself by going through a practice run enough time. That's why fire drills actually do work. So normalcy bias is a weird thing that comes around. People in terrible events, when you have every reason to think otherwise, you will just go, well, maybe it's not that bad. Maybe I could stick around. Maybe I could ride this out. And people who do that, sometimes they face really dire consequences.
Now, has there been any research done, or have we figured out why those first responders that are the ones, you know, the first to react, what goes through their mind? I mean, you said like they go through all the steps, I guess, more quickly than others. But is there something that just, you know, kicks in these people's brains that tells them, I need to react and I need to do it right now?
I don't know. I haven't done any research into specifically what the first responders are thinking. I know that the person I talk about in the book, a researcher named Johnson, he talks about how training over and over again tends to make what would seem like a complex situation to a person who's never trained seem something rote and simple. And, you know, it just being their job to go straight to an alarm state, straight to a state of action. It's like Johnson in the book talks about, it's like playing an instrument. So you go from, if I just hand you a guitar and say, here, play a C chord. No, look, here's how it works. Okay, you put your finger here, you put your finger here. And you may have never picked up a guitar, and it seems like the most complicated thing in the world, and it hurts. But if I hand you a guitar after showing it to you and you practice for 5 minutes, it suddenly starts to unfold and seem simpler. And so Johnson says that first responders, they train so much that they're not afraid of the situation. They know what to look for. They move quickly through the steps, unlike other people who are, that day they just wanted to sit in the office and play solitaire on the computer, and then all of a sudden, what is this? So I don't know for sure, but that's my speculation on it.
You know, you talk a lot about the conscious versus the unconscious mind or brain. That's kind of what drives a lot of our problems, is we don't realize what we're thinking or what's happening. And sometimes it seems like you might want to err on the side of the unconscious, because this is the part of our brain that's had the longest time to evolve and make the most adaptations.
Right.
It appears that it may be more trustworthy. If this is the case, is it a better idea to go with your gut or your intuition when it comes to making decisions? Are we more easily deceived when we move the thought process to our conscious mind?
You know, I try not to step on Jonah Lehrer's toes too much in the book, because he wrote the greatest book on this topic that I've read, and that is How We Decide. And he talks a lot about how, the unconscious mind has had the emotional mind has had a lot longer time to evolve than the rational mind. And then you also have people like Malcolm Gladwell who say that, you know, you should really, really trust your gut reactions. But I think that the science is not 100% in favor of that, because there are many times when your gut reaction is really good, and it's something you can trust, but it's usually after you've done a lot of research or you have a lot of experience in what it is that you are you're contemplating. When you're a complete noob about something, when you're completely novice in the situation, your gut reaction is going to be based off of something else, and it could be priming, it could be any number of the biases that I talk about in the book. It could be based off of faulty information or false premises. So you have to be careful when trusting your gut 100%, especially in a very novel situation. Now, you know, if somebody throws a snake in your lap and you go with your gut and you say, here, you throw it away, that's good. That's all those, all the things I write about serving you well. But if you, this is, for instance, Stephen Levitt in Freakonomics talks about how people aren't very good at judging the statistical danger of something like a gun versus a swimming pool, because we might think that a gun is more dangerous, but statistically a child is much more likely to be harmed by a swimming pool than a gun in a home that has both. So yes, going with your gut can be a good thing, but it also could be really faulty, and it's situational and it's nuanced.
You also talk about how we do things to create a positive self-image for ourselves. Why do you think that we are so scared of, you know, having a negative self-image or even not knowing things? Like, we're so terrified we'll make things up even if it's not right. And it's to get us to a point where we trust ourselves and our thought process. Why do you think that is?
based off of what I have researched, you know, I see that it comes up over and over again in the literature that we are very, very concerned with self-esteem. And we use a number of things to keep that self-esteem rolling along and at its maximum power. Self-esteem plays right into self-efficacy, and self-efficacy makes us attempt things over and over again, even if we're failing, to the point that we eventually will do something. We'll eventually succeed. People who give up too soon may be people who don't believe in their efficacy, and it's because their self-esteem may be not as pumped up and out of control as others. It can obviously go too far, but a healthy dose of self-delusion is sometimes necessary to get out of bed in the morning, to think that you can fight back the endless forces that are pushing against you whenever you try to make your way through the world. You know, we each have a self-esteem model that is built around whatever it is we believe is important to our peers and to ourselves. It could be based off morality. It could be based off of education, intelligence, athleticism. Whatever it is that we use as a metric for our own self-esteem, we tend to see ourselves as above average in that thing. And when we are threatened by the world or by our own observations, and we see that maybe that's not so true, we'll work pretty diligently to bring ourselves back up above the water. I don't think it's always a bad thing. It's, you know, most animals just do what they do. We have that extra metacognition when we think about our thinking. And when we do that, when we look back on our own behaviors, we tend to look back on them as an outside observer. And when we write that story about our lives, we inflate it, we embellish it to make it even better and more interesting than maybe it was in the moment. And this probably all plays back into keeping that self-esteem high so we'll feel effective. And self-effectiveness really serves us well.
Now, David, just from, you know, hearing you speak, it sounds like you enjoy tech and gaming. You know, with the term noob, that's definitely one of those gaming terms that have been coined as of recently. But one of the sections in your book is brand loyalty, and how how men will argue about anything to protect their egos, even if it's the smallest, you know, the smallest thing. And there tends to be a lot of brand loyalty in expensive tech toys. So mm-hmm. I have to ask you this, because Chris and I have this eternal debate going on all the time. Are you a Mac or a PC guy?
I have in my day job as a guy who works in the media, I use PCs, and when I write and I do creative things, I tend to use Mac. I have Mac at home, but then I have my entertainment system is run through a home theater PC that is a PC.
Yep.
So I kind of go back and forth. When I want to, it depends on what I want to do with it, and I totally get the reality distortion field. I've seen people go from proponents of let's build a gaming machine out of a pizza box to talking about intuitive user interfaces overnight after buying a Mac, and it's hard not to do, you know, when you drop that much money on something, to not defend it and defend the philosophy behind it. I think that's what one of the great genius things that was done either by Steve Jobs or by the marketing team there in Apple is that they allow you to buy into the philosophy of the brand before you buy into the utility of the product. And I'm one of the people who I believe that everybody has a reality distortion field, and it's one of those things where they just sort of embraced it and said, sure, okay, Steve Jobs has a reality distortion field. Do you like it? If you like it, then let's put out advertising that points, you know, to that. So he shows the PC guy and the Mac guy standing side by side. And for some people, that's offensive. And for some people, that's very incentivizing, because they're like, hey, I'm not like that guy in the cubicle. I want to be the artist. I want to be the whatever. So I would say I'm a little of both. But lately, the more I devote time to writing, the more I've been a Mac guy.
I'm the same way. I've got, you know, my home theater PC hooked up. I've built my own PC for gaming. And when I want to do creative things, whether it be podcasting or digital editing of photos, videos, etc., it's Mac. And I've been trying to explain to Chris that it's just it's definitely superior in that sense for doing creative things.
I like to be able to hit Control C, and I like my Microsoft Excel. Okay, that's just what I do.
Yeah, you know, use what works for you, and don't get too caught up in the war with other people over what's better. Because I mean, it's okay to like something for an irrational reason. I try to tell people that you like everything for an irrational reason. So there's no reason to suddenly stop now and go, I like PCs because you can get in there and fiddle with the pieces. Well, yeah, that's good. And if that's what you want to do, then please do buy that.
Yeah. Well, I guess if your book teaches us anything, It might even be just not to think, because I'm going to get it wrong anyways. So,
right? I just hope it gives you a humility. You know, let's just, I think that we are connected not only in what we're capable of, but also what we tend to stumble over. Let's not, I just keep trying to tell people, let's not create decisions or policies that point to, you know, when it comes to like trying to create policies around abstinence only programs, you know, that they all assume that people are going to be going to look at the statistics and facts and go, I probably should abstain from having sex before marriage. Right. And that just ignores the fact that people aren't going to do that. They're not going to logically look at the situation and go, I should probably avoid this. So, you know, just accept the fact that we're all flawed. And then if we know what those flaws are going in, then we can have an even better a sense of ourselves and a better sense of have a better common sense.
David, thank you so much. I mean, it was great talking to you. The book was fantastic to read. Again, the book is You Are Not So Smart. And I just wanted to give you a chance to direct our listeners to your website or anything else you might be working on right now.
Everything is up at youarenotsosmart.com. Some stuff for the book is on there. I've written a lot of stuff since the book. I keep getting better at this and writing longer and longer pieces that take much longer to read and write. And you can always go to youarenotsosmart.com and check them out.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show. It's been a lot of fun, and best of luck in the future.
Thanks a bunch.
Welcome back. All right, guys. Came up with a pretty good idea for how we're going to give away David's book.
Free giveaway.
You Are Not So Smart. So, Chris, I came across an email today to Smart People Podcast. It was from Google. And they were saying that our Google Voice number was going to expire in 7 days unless we used it. So this got me to thinking, why don't we give away 2 copies of David's book to the best messages that are left to us on our Google Voice number? So your guy's job is to call into the number 209-920-7678 and leave us a message. You won't talk to anybody. It'll be an automated prompt. And, you know, just go ahead, leave a message. Tell us why you like the show, who you want to hear, what your favorite part of the interview was, really anything. And we'll pick our 2 favorite messages, we'll play them on the air, and we'll send you guys books.
I love this idea. This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever. So the number again is
209-920-7678. That's 209-920-7678.
I think we learned something in marketing class where you have to say something 3 times for it to stick in. I don't know, but whenever you feel like it, if you're just pissed off or something, just give us a call and leave us a message. This will be hilarious. It'll be another way we kind of get in touch with you, and we'll play a couple on the air in the future. It'll be a great time. Also, other ways to get in touch with us: Facebook, Smart People Podcast. Just go click the like button. We're trying to get that community going. We're putting some new pictures up. It's a lot of fun. Check us out on iTunes and our website, smartpeoplepodcast.com. Don't forget Amazon widget at the top and bottom of the page. When you're doing your holiday shopping, just click on the widget. Brings you to Amazon. Any purchase you make gives us a kickback. We appreciate it. We appreciate you listening to the show, guys. We're trying to give you some books and some free stuff. Give us a call. Leave us a message.
209-920-7678.
That's 4 times.
See you guys later.
Psychology.